This is a Momentum Media production.
Nerd alert!
Property Nerds, the home for data-driven property investors, where we uncover Australia's hot and cold markets, latest headlines and trends.
Welcome to another episode of the Property Nerds. I'm your host, Arjun Paliwal from Investikit Buyers Agency, here on another show where we're talking all things about the population, the way it's going, where it's going in terms of a core subject, which is about the aging population in particular. And why is this going to be important for us to know about when it comes to property investors? We'll dig deeper into this in today's show. But before I jump into today's show, I just wanted to highlight some really, really exciting news which has come up now. So as you know, each month we work on releasing some of our white papers with popular demand. They're back again for this month. And for the last couple of months, we've actually been seeing some of the most downloads we've ever seen. So I just wanted to say a big thank you to everyone tuning in. The feedback, the comments that we get as well about how helpful these research papers have been unreal. So I just wanted to say a big shout out and thank you there. But last month, we talked about the overvalued, undervalued markets, or last episode, and they're back again. So the overvalued, undervalued markets, in terms of the white paper, if you haven't already grabbed that, that is available on investikit.com.au. And to give you a sneak peek into the next white paper that's coming up, we'll be talking about Queensland's top areas in more of the affordable budgets around that sort of 500K mark, because that has been asked for a lot. We ran this particular white paper last year, and that was a hugely downloaded one and very popular because everyone wants to know what's happening in Queensland, especially with a lot of the migration, a lot of the affordability in parts of Queensland when it comes to property prices and some of the growth momentum being seen. So with popular demand, that will be back on again for next month's release. In terms of some of the older ones, if you've missed them, we had number 10 of Australia's economic powerhouse cities the month before that, the overvalued, undervalued, the 2024 edition, which was recently released in the last episode, and the one coming up, which will be out this time next month. So tune into that, and we'll be talking about that more in detail in another episode. But for today's topic, I mentioned earlier around the aging population and why that's such a big topic, but also how important that is for investors and just Australians in general today. But when it comes to this topic, you know, I don't want to sit here and pretend that I'm an expert on all things. And this is why I'm very grateful to have some guests come onto the show to help me learn, but also help you learn about what's happening in the space of the population. But more importantly as well, it's that we can link these things towards property investing and make better decisions, smarter decisions, and more just aware decisions. So to have that conversation with me today, I've got a returning guest, Simon from the Demographics Group. So if this is your first time hearing from Simon, to give you some insights, Simon is one of the co-founders of the Demographics Group based in Melbourne. And he's also a regular columnist at The Australian and the New Daily newspapers, which I'm sure many of you have read or checked out. A super engaging speaker, Simon has talked about the post-world of COVID with us last time and the changing landscape of working from home and how that impacted things. And I learned a lot because some of the missing pieces to property investing is not just the data of what we have today in listings and where trends are going or where finance trends are going. It's actually about understanding the future of jobs, economy, people, decisions that people prefer or don't prefer as demographics and the things they like, have interest in, and don't have interest in change. But that is what the end of the day investing is. It's to service a need for a person, right? Whether that be your future you're creating, whether there be a rental house that you're creating and fulfilling, or whether there be a home that you're living in and calling your shelter. There's just those angles that we need to understand, which are more human-driven, economic-driven, people-driven, rather than just the trends of housing. So this is a mind that I was very, very grateful to pick last time, and I can't wait to pick more from this person here today. Simon, welcome to the show, my friend.
That's great to be back on.
Awesome, mate. Well, why don't we start off with on the component of an aging population? Like, what does it actually mean? When someone hears that there is an aging population in the world and or Australia, what does that firstly mean?
Well, in the most simplistic way, it means that we get older and we die later. And it also means that because so many of us get older, on average, the country ages. It's nice if everyone ages and whatever. We live longer lives. That's wonderful. But for a country, it means that we have a higher share of the population in the retirement ages compared to before that. So that means that the existing worker bees, they need to be even more productive in order to finance, in order to service the needs of the aging population that are, from an economical perspective, purely economical perspective, less productive than the workers. So this is why we are getting worried if a country ages. The richer a country is, the easier it can deal with an aging population. And the more a country takes in migrants from overseas, the more you can buffer the aging effect. And what happens, not necessarily worldwide, but in the whole Western world, is we now have this big, fat baby boomer generation aging into retirement. And in about 10, 15 years, they start dying at scale. And that then changes things again.
Yeah. So Simon, when it comes to that, firstly, I had two parts, right? One part though is really that stood out to me is we're living longer. Well, surely that's got some good parts to it, right? I mean, when we're living longer, that's a great thing to celebrate. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely, that is a positive development. You want to live longer. Well, most importantly, you want to have longer and healthier years. So that means you actually need to eat your vegetables and, you know, stay reasonably physically active to actually be able to enjoy and live out the old years in good health. That is an absolute major development. Also, from a housing perspective, I always urge all older people to get the hell out of car-dependent suburbs. What I mean by this is, so we have mental health data available now for the first time linked to census data. So I can pinpoint mental health peaks and troughs in the population and I can look at it geographically. Quite obviously, as soon as your partner dies in old age, your mental health goes down. Makes sense. You live for many decades with them. You kind of love them. And so when they're gone, you are sad. And
kind of. You'd hope they love them more, right? Not the kind of, but.
you'd hope so. And so you see mental health decline. And mental health declines even more if you are living as an old person by yourself in a car-dependent suburb. That's because bit by bit, fewer and fewer people will visit you. So you are more often socially isolated. The older you get, the less frequent your driving becomes. So you leave the house less frequently. And that just further deteriorates your mental health. So I'm quite serious from a just healthcare advice perspective. I tell people in their mid-70s, while they're still, you know, of course the joints hurt, but you're still active enough, move out of your car-dependent suburb, sell the family house, move into a wonderful apartment in a walkable community. That is the best thing you can do for your mental health, particularly once your partner dies. Then this is even better for your mental health. It is always a bit cynical to talk about death and to think about those things in advance, which is why we tend to not do it. So the whole downsizing narrative, which is the property angle of an aging population, is that the more people get old, the more people downsize. Yes, that is true. But overall in Australia, we tend to exaggerate the downsizing narrative because Australians are outrageously hard-headed people and we don't downsize at scale. Some people downsize.
They want
some
those extra space, right? They want the extra room,
Yeah, and it's the idea. This is my family home. This is my family house. Yeah. I feel very invested in it. Plus, financially, it might not be all that attractive. If this thing that I live in accrued wealth year after year, why should I sell it? Plus, then I go, hey, I sell it. I need to pay a bucket load of stupid stamp duty on it. Then I, you know, when I buy a smaller property, it costs a lot of stamp duty. That's not attractive. And right. That is something that stops people from downsizing, plus the whole hard-headedness. And people also quite often are reluctant to change the neighborhood. More people might be interested in downsizing had they a relevant or adequate property two streets further down the road available to them. But quite often, the people that are aging now live in middle suburbs of our big cities. And this is all separate homes and townhomes, townhouses. There are very few apartments available. Of course, these are the big NIMBY suburbs of Australia. They blocked further developments as much as they can. So that makes downsizing further unattractive. So people stay put up to the point where the family home becomes a physical hazard to manage, where it becomes a nuisance to manage at the very least, and then they move out. But quite often Australians will even tell you stuff like, hey, I want to be carried out of my family home. And that's, yeah, I guess that's one way of downsizing into the little box. But more than anything, Australians stay put and we can't do anything about it. At least right now, in theory, you could abolish stamp duty. You could introduce a land tax, which would then make it more attractive to downsize because it's a, hey, I'm paying for the right to live on this relatively big plot of land, whereas I actually only need half of it. If I were to move to a smaller place, I'd have much smaller costs. And you would then allow for more people to downsize. We sometimes talk about right sizing of the property market in that sense, that then more people would free up the family homes and these younger families that are looking for family sized homes, they could then occupy those properties. And we'd, statistically speaking, it would result in fewer spare bedrooms floating around the system. So we better utilize the existing housing stock. I would expect, if I look into my property crystal ball, that we are inching towards policies that are abolishing stamp duty. So yeah. I don't think that stamp duty can live through another decade in this country.
It's been a very unproductive tax. And what you've talked about is it's productive for, I mean, government's pockets in one way, which have large amounts that it brings in, but it's unproductive in the way that it's so seasonal. It could change on so many sentiment points of transaction volumes shifting and not giving consistent revenue line items. But I can see the mammoth of a change that is, and hence why it keeps getting a can kicked down the road. But like you're saying, it structurally needs to happen if we're going to see some certain changes. But taking one step back, Simon, I want to figure out firstly, for those who are new to the problem, how did we get here? Like, how do we get here when it comes to not stamp duty as such, but how did we get here in Australia and globally to have such an aging population to begin with?
Well, so the aging population has, in the current layup, has two main things. So the obvious thing is that for a very, very long time, birth rates have been declining. So each generation makes fewer babies per woman than the generation prior. What is occurring right now is that at one point, yes, from forever onwards, the birth rate has been declining. But at some point, there was this point in time when the birth rates shot up and were really elevated for a while. That is the baby boomer generation. So just after the end of the Second World War, for those nations most impacted by the Second World War, there was pent up demand for baby making, if you will. There was a sense of optimism of finally we lived through the First World War, the Second World War, the Great Depression. All these things are behind us. Finally, it's time to be more optimistic. It was also more technology came online. Cars became a thing. You know, labor-saving devices made it much easier to run a household, vacuum cleaners, fridges, washing machines. You cannot underestimate how important those inventions were for the impact on daily life. So all of these things were wonderful developments. We make more babies. So we have this gigantic baby boomer generation. And just by throwing this big generation at a country that changes everything forever. And baby boomers really changed every stage of the life cycle, also every stage of the housing life cycle we ever touched. The impact that baby boomers had to begin with is that there was a big cohort entering the labor market all at the same time. So the competition for labor was very high. That put a downward pressure on prices. So you earned less than a worker before that. But the baby boomers still had one ace up their sleeves. They threw women into the workforce. This was the first generation for women to enter the workforce at scale. That means, statistically speaking, Australian households went from one household income to 1.5 household incomes.
Huge change.
Again, also linked to labor-saving devices. If you have a washing machine, if you have a vacuum cleaner, if you have a fridge, you need to shop less frequently. You need to, cleaning is much easier. Washing took a whole day of the week back in the day. Now it didn't. So all of this freed up women also to actually join the workforce, at least for in a part-time capacity. So you add an additional half an income to the Australian household. And what did we do with this money? Well, more than anything, Australians purchased cars. And even relatively modest families could afford a relatively modest car. And before that, before baby boomers got their car keys, the Australian cities were relatively dense, similar in density to European cities. So you give those families or those couples that are now making babies, you give them a car key. They drive up the road until they can afford a quarter acre block. Wonderful. They slap on a brick veneer and a Hills hoist in the back. They live the Australian dream. If they're Greeks, they put up a couple of columns in the front door and life is wonderful.
Lovely.
The next family needs to drive 15 meters further down the road. And the next family, another 15. And the next family, another 15. And that's essentially how we grew our capital cities in Australia for the last 60 years. We completely pancaked and sprawled out our cities. And that has to do with baby boomers having cars. We created this car-dependent suburbia. Our population density now is much, much lower compared to cities of similar size in Europe. If you compare Melbourne, where I live, population density with the population density of Berlin, where I used to live before that, Melbourne has a population density that is 8 times lower than the one in Berlin.
Wow.
That means each Melburnian needs to pay for so much more kilometers of road, of rail, of electricity grid, of sewage, blah, blah, blah. It's super, super expensive to run a sprawled out city. And so we wonder why, oh, why isn't our public transport as great as it is in Madrid, London, or Paris? Well, guess what? This is what you get for a sprawled out city. You create this car dependent big city. Certain places like Sydney, they sprawled out so much that they reached the Blue Mountains, a physical barrier. So you can't sprawl out more, which is why house prices went up more in Sydney. You just couldn't grow out. Melbourne is more open to most directions, you know, other than the bay. And so you can sprawl out, sprawl out, sprawl out. You could continue this. So the average house price in Melbourne is more affordable, not affordable by any means, but more affordable than it is in Sydney because you can sprawl it out even more. Couple of problems. You build over valuable farmland that we have limited farmland of in Australia. So that's a bit of a problem. Yeah, but that's the effect that how we created our cities. Now, if you zoom into what the baby boomers did, they purchased those homes many, many decades ago. And now over the 2030s and 40s, they will slowly be dying out of those family homes. That is a direct effect of the aging of baby boomers. We know that they will not downsize at scale. They will sit there until they get carried out of their homes. What will happen then to this lot? Well, they have 2.5 kids on average. So their 2.5 kids will either sell the house to a relatively cashed up family and they'll split the difference.
Trust fund babies. This is the trust fund babies coming up, huh?
Yeah, to a degree, it's not that ritzy because if you look at a house that might easily be worth $1.5 to $2.5 million, depending on where it is, you know, you split this times three, it is decent money.
Yes.
It's not enough to buy a house, to be honest.
But it gives them a deposit, gives them a starting point.
People that are inheriting the money, they would be in their 50s and 60s. So they don't even need the money because their kids have already left the family home. So the additional new money, I would argue, will overwhelmingly be invested into investment properties. That's what Australians do. Whenever you throw money at an Australian, they go buy an investment property. It's somehow deeply ingrained in our DNA because property did so well over the last decades. And so as the baby boomer houses all get liquidated, you give it to people and they will desperately look for investment opportunities.
So Simon, this is an example of some of the moves that can come with this money, right? And that's, you know, like you've talked about, downsizing is one, but probably not a big favor. Then you've got inheritances and how that splits into the age group coming in. I want to take a moment to understand though, let's just say that aside, and we can talk globally as well, for examples, if that helps. When the aging population happens, or it's happening, but as it happens, what are some examples globally where things haven't been a rosy picture? And what could those examples look like? Because we've always been known in Australia as the lucky country, right? Many things happen well, whether it's escaping the GFC or whether it's escaping many other impacts of COVID as much as, say, other countries did, whether it's coming off an economic rebound or a jump up off the back of COVID and handling certain things better. This is a debate that goes on, but we've often been known in both locally and globally as the lucky place. What happens when the aging population, as an example, globally, if countries have happened and seen this already, where maybe it's turned into a more bleak picture and it hasn't been so rosy.
Yeah, well, so you always want to make sure that there is enough money in the system to pay for your aging and economically unproductive populations. So, and the bigger the population, the more money you need to throw at them to make sure that they're all fed. And healthcare costs, of course, massively go up with each year of age. So you want to be rich. We have aging countries that are not rich, and this is where people live in destitution. They don't have a great retirement. Australia did see this. So it's easy to be cynical about politics, but sometimes we have to be absolutely grateful for political foresight that occurred. In the 1990s, early 1990s, we introduced superannuation to Australia. Superannuation can be seen as an annoying thing because we put a gun to your head and we say, hey, 10, now 12% of your income, you actually don't get it. We put this into a bucket and there the money accrues, and whatever, and it creates more wealth. What this is, we ensure that you pay for your own retirement. If we fully relied on a nationally financed pension scheme, we realized as soon as the baby boomers retired, the system would break. There's too much of a cohort retiring all at once. We can't possibly take care of them financially. We force our people to save enough money so they can pay for their own retirement. Middle and high income earners put enough money in their super to fully pay for their own retirement. Low income earners, they need to only be subsidized through the pension scheme. We don't need to pay for their whole retirement because they have at least some sort of savings in their superannuation account. That is something that we did beautifully. As long as a country, we tend to say, as long as a country grows rich before it grows old, all is well. Japan is obviously the most famous example of an aging society. So they ran out of workers because they got so old. But there's still, there's lots of difficulties because it's just birth rates plummeted massively. But the economy still works because Japan is very unique in its business model. The Japanese business model says we create wealth by producing high-tech goods and a bit of insurance. That's all that Japan does on the international stage. And so they could just take their factories and put them into a different country. So now a Japanese company, Toyota, is building cars in Vietnam and they're using Vietnamese labor and they re-import the profits. That is something that Japan could be doing. Not all countries can do this because not all countries can use a foreign labor force outside of the country. This is why Japan could shrink its population base, completely forego immigration for quite a while. They're now taking in Korean migrants as well, but bit by bit. But they could go without migration because productivity could be outsourced. That is something that a place like Australia can't do. The Australian business model very much relies on people in the country. We make money by doing four things. Mining, that means we need people or robots doing stuff in Australia. Agriculture, same story. Machines or people doing stuff in Australia. International education, theoretically, you could have campuses outside of the country, but more than anything, we take in migrants into this country. And the last one is tourism. Tourism obviously needs to be taking place in Australia. So we cannot go without imported labor. So we know that Australia is pretty much set on a path of high migration. There's no plausible government that I'd see that would slow down the migration impact. Part of this has to do with the aging of the population, which ultimately leads to a diminished labor pool. But the aging of the population also, as long as the country is rich enough, creates massive demands of jobs. What I mean by this is the 85 plus cohort. So 85, statistically speaking, when we talk about the aging population, is the most important year because 85 is the median age of death. That means half of us won't make it to 85. It's anyone's guess whether it's you or me who makes it past 85. But then the remaining population that makes it past 85, half of them, they need assistance with activities of daily life. They need care. And we are doubling the 85 plus cohort from 550,000 people to 1.1 million people in just 14 years.
What a change. What a change. Massive.
And if you've ever been to an aged care home in the last decade or so, you know who's doing the care work. This is almost exclusively imported labor. So first and foremost, if you are 75 today, and in a decade you hope to get the care that you need, you better be rich. Because we need to just import so much labor that obviously the bottom end of the market will be hit the hardest. Some people might be able to buffer this kind of blow through family care, but lots and lots of people will just live through old age with inadequate care. And that is absolutely god-awful. And that is something that you cannot morally accept as a country. So we will import as many care workers as we can get forever onwards. No government will argue against this. No plausible government that I can think of, at least.
Right.
So migration, so from a, you know, bringing this back to property investment, I would say that a high migration approach is all but guaranteed in the next decade, particularly because over the next decade, you see the complete baby boomer cohort exiting the world of work. So you have this big chunk of now old workers completely leaving the world of work. At the other end of the spectrum, you have a smaller cohort entering the world of work. So you'd be shrinking the workforce. That's not good, particularly because over the next decade, we have the biggest generation, absolute numbers at the moment, the millennials continuing to make babies. That means they go on parental leave. They at least temporarily leave the world of work behind. So skills shortage is here to stay. No two opinions about this. So whatever business you run, whatever way you think you can make money, keep this in the back of your mind. If you want to make the majority of your money through property investment, make sure that you have a decent strategy of or decent connection, a network of people who can actually do the repairs for you, who can do all the, you know, if you rely on any kind of service work, if you don't do absolutely everything yourself, this will dry out, this pool. It'll not completely, disappear, but you'll have fewer of them. That means the cost to purchase any kind of labor should go up, no matter what you're looking at. And then we look at particular jobs, and they have a steeper retirement cliff than others. A retirement cliff is what I define as what share of the workforce is in the 10 years leading up to retirement.
Right.
And so nationally speaking, 15% of the workforce is in the 10 years pre-retirement age. So they will fall off the retirement cliff in a decade. That's the image here. And then there are certain jobs that have a higher proportion of the workers in that bracket. Truck drivers, for example, 28% of truck drivers are nearing retirement. So guess what? We will be importing all those truck drivers. Right now, at 27 million people, Australia relies on 200,000 truck drivers to keep this country moving, ticking along. And we'd be screwed without them. We will not get rid of them. You could kind of say, self-driving cars, self-driving trucks. Yeah, to a degree, maybe in some use cases, but the whole self-driving car thing will be much, much slower than people predict. We will be importing truck drivers for the next five decades for sure. Again, higher migration intake. There's certain jobs we cannot go without. We will import them as long as people are willing to come to Australia.
So that's an interesting take now here on that, because I think what people listening to this need to learn, just to take a moment and digest, is that we will continue to see and must have migration as a core focus in this country to allow both skills gaps, to allow both where those overproportioned percentages are to have softer landings, and to bring down the average age when you look at the total population. Because if I'm not mistaken, migrants typically would come in from either the student categories in the late teens, 20s, to the working category in life of setting up family in their 30s, maybe 40s, but maybe sitting more in these younger brackets that we're looking at. Now, when we look at all of this change, you touched on it earlier on some of the inheritance pieces and that transfer of wealth and how that might be to many kids in their 50s. They'd be loving and loving it if I called them kids, right?
Yeah.
So I think from that perspective, it hasn't come in time though, unlike what we're going to see in the next 10, 15 years, to that much of an acute amount all in one go, right? In the past, it hasn't been something that we've reportedly seen on the charts that I could bring up. So when you imagine that much though in frequency and how acute it will be over the 2030s, late 2030s, how do you see that impacting our economies when, yes, in their 50s, have this much cash thrown into the system, whether it be through downsizes or inheritances.
Yeah.
What do you see it being as a different landscape for property investors?
Yeah. So if you inherit money as an empty nester, essentially, you don't need much more money. You can use it, pay down the mortgage, buy an investment property. But ultimately, a big chunk of the wealth transfer from the baby boomer generation to the millennials will skip the millennials because the millennials don't need it at this stage. The millennials very much struggled from probably the hardest hit generation by house prices in the country in the recent history because house prices went up and up and up. They started making babies late in life. Then house prices became ever more expensive. They were locked out of the housing market. And there's no slowdown in sight in the short term, at least until the 2030s and 40s, when structurally there's so much property entering the market that it could slow down house price growth. But so they struggle through it. Millennials will be fine in retirement. They will be able to afford decent accommodation. And it's important that you are a homeowner in retirement. Statistically speaking, that very much rules you out from suffering from poverty in old age. So it's important to just have zero housing costs or close to zero housing costs in old age. And then even a relatively modest pension can get you along. So that's the goal. Millennials should be fine with that, even though more and more of them will not become homeowners, which is quite dramatic, if you will. But their kids, people that are being born, you know, in the last 5 years and in the next 15 years or so, they'll be fine. They'll get the inheritance of their grandparents. That'll get them along. So their millennial parents can help them very much to enter the housing market early on. And that's something that the millennials will carry around with them as a thing like, ah, screw this. I've been screwed over by this. And I want my kids to have it easier, better than me. So millennials carry the cross of being the first generation, as it is always very often mentioned, the first generation in Australia that is doing less great, financially speaking, than their own parents. That has a couple of psychological impacts. You might constantly feel shortchanged. But then again, millennials are like every other generation ever. They want their kids to be better off than them. And they'll have a bit of cash floating around in their 50s, which is then their 50s and 60s, which is then when their kids will be in their early 30s, which is family formation stage. And that's helpful. Also, as all of this is happening, we must be aware that, you know, politics, planning systems are a bit smarter than we sometimes do them justice. We now reached a breaking point in Australia, and now the general consensus across all levels of politics increasingly is that we need more housing supply in order to drive down house prices, in order to make sure that we can increase the share of the population that becomes a homeowner. So we know roughly that policies will be geared towards more supply. So, you know, if you look at the property crystal ball, if you will, property policy crystal ball, I would say supply will be pushed wherever you can. We will try to right-size property. That means Airbnbs and holiday homes will be punished in some way or form. I would say that stamp duty is out, land tax is in the next decade. So these are a couple of big picture perspectives that I have, you know, in my crystal ball.
Well, Simon, that's great to unpack all of this here with you. It's given me a lot of context of what property investors need to be thinking about. And some of the notes I've taken down and the lessons I'm picking out of this is that, you know, if we're starting from firstly understanding there was a big amount of transformational change that happened back when the baby boomers first had, whether it be the inventions, whether it be post-war confidence, or whether it be, you know, the family and the double incomes or 1.5 income starting to come into play, that and how it's all created. Our second thing I took out was a big part around where global examples haven't worked out as well, but also locally what we have going for us across those four areas of agriculture, mining, tourism as another one. And so when we're looking at all of these factors, migration and the student aspect you mentioned too, the migration will play a huge part in it and will continually be a part of Australia as we get more and more diverse as the time goes on. Summarizing all of that, what that really meant for me though was it sounds like, number one, the rental markets will continue to stay strong for some time. And you can look at that in the half glass full and empty. In the empty part, you can say, hey, it's not going to be easier conditions anytime soon. And on the full, as a property investor growing their portfolio with the costs that exist today, whether that be government and inflicted costs from taxes, or whether it be costs of, you know, actual living and actual costs of things to do with your actual interest rates, these things are all going to have that offset of rising rents with the projections ahead. But even then, when I think of another thing that's come up, is I don't think the bank of mom and dad will die anytime soon, based on the flow of the, you know, the older population you're seeing and the impacts of that generational wealth transfer. It's not going to hit the millennials directly, but indirectly, it will give that older generation ahead of the millennials a bit of a way to look back and go, I've got a bit of a cushion coming in from here. I feel a little bit more comfortable, even more so, even though they already are quite comfortable, to give that bank of mom and dad to support that growth of millennials investing in property or having their first home. And in summary, when I think of this, taxes, wow, like they are blocking a lot of mobility, whether it be amongst the downsizing, whether it be the direction of where people need to go and want to go versus where they can go when they look at it financially. This change would no doubt bring upon some more movement and create some more stock that's focused on the future rather than the stock of the past. And no doubt all of this coming together, property investors will start to see improved rent, improved economies with migration coming through and continuing this, and also prosperity that continues to flow through as different types of dwellings and types of houses that come into all shapes and sizes as, you know, taxes and things reshape themselves and we have more of a supply conversation. So huge amounts of learning for me. I've taken out so much, my friend. Any last words to share with the audience as they're thinking about maybe some of the things I didn't cover off or didn't quite grasp as well as you felt I should have?
No, plenty more to chat about. Just another, maybe second your motion of the importance of the bank of mom and dad. Mm. That is outrageously lucrative if you think about it as the whole family unit. You know, we're close to around 5.3% interest rates or mortgage rates, roughly. And just happens to be that under a 30-year mortgage, 5.3% means a $400,000 mortgage costs $800,000. This is what you repay. So it's the exact doubling in that time frame. So you should always think of a mortgage as a poverty penalty, because you are not rich enough to pay for the house in cash. You need to pay more for the house. The mortgage portion, at least, is going to double. What that means, though, if you think about this from a family unit, if mom and dad can give you $100,000, they reduce your mortgage from $400,000 to $300,000. That means they double the money that they give you, essentially, because you don't need to repay $800,000. You need to repay $600,000. So it is absolutely smart as a family unit to act like the bank of mom and dad. So that is easy. You know, you're not supposed to give financial advice, blah, blah. But from a financial advice perspective, this is great. Do this. Be the bank of mom and dad. Absolutely. From a societal perspective, it further splits Australia in two. It means that those people that do not have access to the bank of mom and dad, they're being put even further behind in the property game. And I'm not sure how to fix this, because, you know, the bank of mom and dad is allowed to do whatever the hell it wants. And splitting this, you know, writing, if you will, this social injustice, that is hard. Because in a scenario where two people have the exact same job, the exact same income, and one has the bank of mom and dad and the other one doesn't, the one who has access to the bank of mom and dad is miles ahead.
No doubt. No doubt at all. And from this there, mate, thank you so much today for your time. Lots of insights on the world of aging population, both globally and locally, and how that needs to make it as a thought of what property investors should consider. And also, I think whilst that may seem a thing that's distant, it's not that far. You know, 10, 15 years is literally around the corner when you're thinking of investment landscape, because people shouldn't be just thinking of today. They should be thinking of the 10 to 20 years ahead. So Simon, thank you again for joining us on the Property Nerd Show.
It's been a pleasure.
Cheers.
The information featured in this podcast is general in nature and does not take into consideration your financial situation or individual needs, and should not be relied upon. Before making any investment, insurance, tax, property, or financial planning decision, you should consult a licensed professional who can advise whether your decision is appropriate for you. Guests appearing on this podcast may have a commercial relationship with the companies mentioned.
Game over.